You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. And we're interrupting our regular show to make an important announcement. As you may have noticed, my regular co-host Rob Ferret is off the show today. Rob is changing directions in his career, and he'll be going back to school to get a PhD in cosmetology. He's got a lot of gifts in that field. Beginning next week, Rob is going to be replaced by Prairie Home Companion host Garrison Keillor, who for unknown reasons has agreed to take a drastic cut in both pay and prestige. We hope you understand why we had to move in that direction. But before we give our last farewell to Rob, I just want to say, happy April Fool's Day. Rob is with his family today, and he'll be back tomorrow. Okay, so there was my shot at an April Fool's joke. Rob, fans can blame the producers of the show if they gave you a shock. Right now, though, we dig into what makes something funny. Director of the Humor Research Lab in Boulder, Colorado, Peter McGraw, and award-winning journalist Joel Werner teamed up to crack the code on what makes us laugh. After traveling the world to places like Tanzania, Japan, Palestine, they wrote their new book, which is out today. It's called The Humor Code, A Global Search for What Makes Things Funny. Peter and Joel, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having us on.
Okay, so as we just heard, today is April Fool's Day, which usually is associated with a certain kind of humor, more a prank than anything else, usually making you think something is true when it's really not. How successful is that kind of humor, Peter?
Well, it depends a little bit on who you're doing it with and how well you thought out this prank. Do you have any idea how long your producers had been planning that one?
I think it was just hatched this morning, actually. So, yeah, it's not an elaborately thought-out prank, but I think it should shock Rob when he gets back.
Yeah, I think the key with this idea is that it can't obviously be a fake prank, especially on April Fool's Day. There has to be some belief. So you started to lose me at PhD in cosmetology at that point. At that moment, it seemed maybe a little bit too obvious.
I was going to say poultry science. Would that have been better?
Did it become a butcher?
I don't know. All right, so it has to be something that's believable. And Joel, you traveled with Peter to get a feel globally for what makes things funny and experience culture, the humor culture in different places around the world. What did you discover as you traveled around? Is there something as universal funny?
We asked that very question specifically when we went to Japan. Because for us, we assumed that the comedy in Japan would be the most foreign imaginable for Americans like us. And in truth, the comedy that we experienced there, these sadistic Japanese game shows we sat in on, it did seem pretty foreign to us. But then when we sat down and interacted with some of these comedians who were boiling their faces in these giant pots of soup for these shows, we found that we could connect in more universal humor, kind of interpersonal.
Can you describe one of the game shows for us that you sat in on?
Sure. So one thing that most people probably don't realize about these Japanese game shows that many people might have seen on YouTube clips is that the majority of the contestants are trained comedians. The belief is the average everyday Japanese person wouldn't be able to show the level of pain and turmoil that they want for these shows. So we set it on a show where the contestant literally had to pick up pieces of fish out of boiling soup, and depending on how fast he was able to do this, his colleagues would be crushed inside a glass case by a giant inflating balloon.
And did you think that was funny while you were there?
We were not laughing out loud. Pete, would you agree with that?
Yeah, for us it seemed a little too painful. We were a little bit too close to it all. You know, we could really see that this was not a fake gag, and that the comedian wasn't actually overacting in this case.
And Peter, you've developed something, sort of a universal theory of humor called, to paraphrase, benign violation. So some sort of expected convention is violated, but it's harmless. And that, it seems like, is what makes things funny. Can you flesh that out a little for us? Where did that come from, that idea?
Well, so I think this idea, like many of our psychological and emotional experiences, you know, has its roots in our more primitive ancestors. So the idea that benign violations really developed originally out of physical and ecological threats, so physical threats that ended up being harmless, social interactions that could be that were threatening but could be explained away. So you can see this in non-human primates and apes and chimps in rough and tumble play. They when they engage in this kind of play fighting, it's actually typically the victim who laughs. This is called play panting, but this is sort of the background to human laughter, this ha 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 kind of sound. And one of the really fascinating things that we learned during the Humor Code project was it seems that even rats tend to experience a similar kind of physiological reaction, a positive reaction, in these ultrasonic chirps that some people call rat laughter.
I want to talk about the benign violation theory and try to get an example here. This is Louis C.K., who, Peter, you actually talked to and tried to get some some wisdom out of. It didn't go that well, but we'll listen to his comedy, which is what he's known for, not his philosophizing about humor. And this is from his HBO special called Oh My God. And he's just brought up this notion that each person has two sides to their brain, a good side and a bad side, and of course side, and a but maybe side. And here's a clip from that.
Okay, like of course, children who have nut allergies need to be protected. Of course. We have to segregate their food from nuts, have their medication available at all times, and anybody who manufactures or serves food needs to be aware of deadly nut allergies. Of course. But maybe, if touching a nut kills you, you're supposed to die.
Okay, Louis C.K. doing what he does. And Peter, why is that funny?
Well, one of the things is that Louis C.K. has worked, I think, really hard to make that bit, which really sits on the edge of going too far, finding a way to make that funny. And the way he does this is that he spends a lot of time setting up this idea that in his heart, he knows that you need to protect these people. This is the of course, the of course, the of course. And then he says the thing that deep down we might be thinking that we often don't want to say. And that's the but maybe part. That's the violation. So he sets up a way to make this violation benign. And my guess is that he spent, you know, a year trying to get that bit exactly right in order to get that huge laugh, so that the audience can see this is wrong, yet okay.
Joel, stand-up comedians like Louis C.K., they develop their material sometimes over years, honing it to make the joke just exactly funny. Do you think they know what they're doing, or are they just sort of noodling around?
Oh, I don't think they're noodling around at all. What's funny is that we met with Louis C.K. briefly before a show in Denver, and he, at that point, acted like your stereotypical road-weary comic. He was not that interested in hearing about Pete's theory, and actually shut Pete down after just a minute or two, saying he doesn't think it's as simple as one scientific theory for humor. However, it's clear that successful comedians like Louis C.K. are experimenting. These guys are using science, whether they call it or not. That these guys experiment with their material night after night after night, and they look at the results and they tweak it, and there's not one right process. There's not one set of rules these guys follow. But if you're going to be successful, you have to create some sort of formula, some sort of process that works for you.
And yet, Peter, people were kind of resistant to the notion that there could be sort of a theory on what makes things funny, that even though it's this universal thing that everybody does, everybody everywhere laughs at something or the other, why has there been resistance to try to pin it down and figure out what it is, why it happens?
I think the resistance is twofold. So some of the resistance are from the professionals out there the Louis C.K.'s of the world. And we chalk that up to the magician who doesn't want his tricks revealed. So if the audience is sitting there trying to dissect the act, you can see the secret sauce, they worry that it may diminish their product, in a sense. The other part is that I think that people enjoy the mystery of it all, the idea that comedy is this sort of special thing, and, you know, science has other more important things to do. Don't go messing with this little bit of magic that I tend to enjoy. My feeling about this is that it's such an important thing, and there's enough people who do it badly, that if we can get some additional insights through science, it seems worth trying to crack the humor code.
Well, we're talking right now with Peter McGraw, director of the Humor Research Lab at the University of Colorado Boulder, and Joe Warner, award-winning former staff writer of the alt-weekly Westword. And we're talking about their new book, The Humor Code, A Global Search for What Makes Things Funny. And we'd like to hear from you. What do you think makes something funny? Is it possible to pin it down and to have a theory that works across the board? Can anything be funny in the right hands? And what about an April Fool's joke that you played that went over pretty well? You can share it with us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. It's April Fool's Day, and we're back with Peter McGraw and Joel Warner, the authors of the book, The Humor Code, A Global Search for What Makes Things Funny. And we want to hear from you on this. What do you think makes something funny? What tickles your funny bone more than anything else? Is it possible to have a grand unified theory of funny? And you can also call up and share some of your April Fool's pranks. Our number, 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. And Peter, certain questions have been kicking around comedy for a long time. For instance, who's funnier, men or women, Democrats or Republicans? And in that last vein, Stephen Colbert has had a big hand in political comedy lately. Let's listen to his take on the Bible.
The people who work with the homeless say don't give them money. It's a bad thing. You're an enabler. You're enabling their alcohol or their drug habit.
Remember what Jesus said about giving things to people you don't know. For I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty, and you gave me drink. I was a stranger, and you took me in. Suckers, this is a fake beard. I'm secretly rich. My dad's God. Burn!
Stephen Colbert. Peter, how do you think Stephen Colbert does when it comes to funny and applied to your theory? Is he working the same theorem that everyone else is?
Well, he's been doing quite well until his show's Twitter account took his jokes out of context. One of the things that Stephen does very nicely is he plays this character. He plays this sort of over-the-top pundit who has really extreme views. And yet, at the same time, he's making fun, he's satirizing the things that seem to be wrong in the world with the way politicians act, the way the media acts, the hypocrisy that we see sort of day in and day out as he reports the news. I think lately the line's getting a little bit blurred between who Stephen Colbert is as a performer and is Stephen Colbert as just a regular kind of guy. But he certainly seems to have that magic touch. He also has a pretty strong writer's room, I suspect. So it's not just Stephen who's writing these jokes, but a group of really smart, funny people along the way who are really hitting that sweet spot most of the time.
Let's go to our phone lines now. We've got Catherine on the line from Evansville. Hi, Catherine.
Hi. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I am good.
What do you think?
Well, I played a prank on a whole entire class today. I'm an educational assistant, and I was in a science class with a teacher, and we were in on it together. And I told her, when you see me stand up and go to the window, I need you to just ask me what I'm doing. So I went over to the window, and I started snapping pictures on my camera phone. And as you know, you can hear that. It clicks. And she goes, Mrs. Short, are you taking pictures? What are you doing? And I said, oh, my gosh, there's a ton of deer out here. I said, there's like 10 deer. They're right out here. And the kids are like, really? And I said, yeah, come see. So they came over to the window, and they're looking, and they're opening the other blind, and they're looking. And I'm like, right there, don't you see? And they're like, no, where are they? Right there. And finally I just said, April Fool's. And they said, what? And I said, April Fool's. And they went, oh, my gosh, you got the whole class.
With your imaginary deer herd.
Yes.
Okay, thanks, Catherine. The students of Catherine disappointed. They did not see any deer. Joel, does that fit the formula?
Oh, sure. I mean, this was very much a mild violation. And clearly in a class like that where folks would know each other, you want to have mild violation folks that things that folks can laugh at together, you know. Where, you know, if you were trying to get a whole, you know, something on television or the radio or whatnot, you might want a more, you know, a slightly more serious violation, a slightly more extensive prank. But that seems the perfect thing to do when you're joking around with friends and colleagues.
Now, before we go too much further, in the same vein, actually, one thing that comes up is whether or not where the line is for humor. If you can find humor everywhere, if there are certain places that are just a humor black hole and you cannot make jokes there. And one place that you sort of put this to the test to is in Palestine, where you ask the question, can you find humor where you least expect it? Joel, can you tell us what happened there?
Well, we decided to go to Palestine. We didn't have much of a plan other than we truly believed that we were going to find a lot of comedy in the West Bank. And thankfully for us in the book, we did. We found the West Bank's version of Saturday Night Live. We found stand-up comedians. We found professors who were dedicating their careers to collecting the jokes that the Palestinians were creating. And it makes a lot of sense. I mean, if you think about the benign violation theory, if you're living in a place that's full of violations, you're going to find ways to make those benign.
Are there places, though, Peter, that are just funny free zones? Not in terms of a geographical place, but maybe a situation that really nobody should ever joke about ever.
You know, some of it depends on what culture you belong to. So in Japan, one of the things that was really striking was the lack of laughter in public places, in businesses, in educational settings. But that's just because the Japanese have very clear delineations about where it's okay to make jokes and where it's not. In the United States, it's a much more open culture in that way, where there's almost no place that's off limits. Even if people say that a funeral is no place to laugh, you can actually still find a great deal of joking and reminiscing and so on. We actually spent some time in Jerusalem, and we met a Holocaust survivor there. And we asked her about where was there humor? Did she experience humor? And what her take on it was that yes, it happened. It happened infrequently, and it happened in sort of moments of safety, moments of satiation after people had had a meal when they were in a work camp. But her time in Auschwitz, she couldn't recall many times where things were okay enough for people to be able to share a laugh. Things were just so dark, so depressing, so scary that you really couldn't find the kind of laugh that you wanted, even amongst the most hardy individuals.
I guess that gets at the benign part of it, that you can't be in a situation that's too dire or you're kind of crossed that line.
Well, I think that you get that with gallows humor sometimes. You know, you get people making jokes at the guillotine. And my guess about that, so first of all, universities won't let you study that kind of stuff for obvious reasons. the other though is that I think that these are people who have accepted their fate in some way. And so they're comfortable with their own demise and they're able to laugh in the face of death. You know, most people aren't able to get to that place for obvious reasons.
Let's go back to our phones now. Eric is joining us from Endeavor. Hi, Eric.
I know we're out of time, so I'll just make this quick, Victoria, and I'll take my laughter off the air. But last year, I called my wife. We had taken our kids out of school and put them in a different school in the next county over, and about a week later, I had a coworker call my wife and explain that she was a sheriff's deputy, and she had a warrant for her arrest and needed to turn herself in.
Ah.
Pretty entertaining for
me. Yeah. That's a good one, Dan. Thanks a lot. Sorry, just getting back at Eric for calling me Victoria. Anyway, what do you think about that practical joke?
I don't know. I want to know if they're still married.
Yeah, that was a good question. It sounds like it went over. He sounded pretty happy, so I'm guessing Eric and his wife are still going strong. Let's go next to Jess in Viroqua. Hi, Jess.
Hi. I'm a firm believer that all comedy is rooted in other people's pain. And that can be demonstrated by if anyone has ever seen a video of someone being kicked between the legs and laughed, it's funny because it's not you.
So kind of a Schadenfreude theory of comedy. Peter, is there anything to that?
Well, certainly, I can't agree with the idea that all comedy follows from that observation, but certainly a lot of it does. Right? So you think about the slapstick comedy, you think about the comedy that you found in the Charlie Chaplin silent films. It certainly had this notion that what Hobbes called this notion of sudden glory, and really translates into a theory of superiority. The issue, though, is that ignores, for instance, things like self-deprecating humor, where you make fun of yourself, and you do so in such a way that you entertain others at your own expense. And that actually is a very useful way to do it. So when Joel and I were in Los Angeles, we looked at who was funny, and we spent a lot of time hanging out with comedians. And one thing that we noticed was that a lot of stand-up comedians, they start with that kind of a joke. They make fun of their imperfections. They get the laugh. And then it gives them some license to point out what's wrong with the rest of the world.
So you get a little humor credit.
Exactly. You get a little license, you get the sure laughs, and then you can move on to other topics.
Well, Peter, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
And Joel, it's great to have you along, too. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Peter McGraw, director of the Humor Research Lab at the University of Colorado Boulder, and Joel Warner, award-winning former staff writer for the alt-weekly Westword. Together, they are co-authors of the book The Humor Code, a global search for what makes things funny.